This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The time for community banks and credit unions to win is now. While the big players and exciting new challenges grab headlines, regional institutions are at the heart of the banking ecosystem, putting the service back into financial services. Serving their local communities, these organisations around the world have a unique advantage over their competitors. They have deep, established roots with their customers. They offer a local, personal service, and they're not tangled up in the legacy tech mess that the big banks are. To read, watch, and listen to what else we've got to say about them and how they can win, visit 11fs.com/communitybanks. That's 11fs.com/communitybanks.
Hello and welcome to FinTech Insider Insights. I'm David Breer, CEO here at 11FS. Let me ask you, what has 200 billion lines and is used by 43% of banks? That isn't some illicit drug, by the way. We're talking about code lines here. It pretty much drives every global financial system all around the world. It is the subject of today's episode in a cozy little fireside chat that we're going to be having with our 11FS CTO to dive into the world of COBOL, Common Business-Oriented Language. So Ewan and myself are going to get together and talk a little bit more about this. But this computer programming language has been used in financial services for decades, and it is estimated around about 220 billion lines of COBOL still currently in use, powering systems we rely on to manage our money and move it around the world. But just because it's always been used, does it really mean it should be continued to being used? And we're going to explore exactly what COBOL is and why banks continue to use it, and how can we move away from COBOL, and really what are the implications of not doing that. If you find this episode interesting and decide you want to learn a little bit more, you can check out our Decoding Banking series, where Ewan and the rest of the team over on our 11FS YouTube channel explain this and many more other basic banking concepts. I think you're going to love that. I've heard from a lot of organizations around the world that they use it for training for their people. So it sounds like it went down pretty well, which is good. All right, let's get on with the discussion. I am delighted, as I said, to be joined by Ewan Silver, the CTO here at 11FS. How's it going, Ewan?
Yeah, good, David. Yourself? It's been a while since we've done one of these things.
Well, I mean, we just literally come off our ventures management meeting as well to sort of chatting about various different things. And it was like, I'll see you in 3 minutes for the podcast talking about COBOL, which is fun. So, it's an interesting subject matter. And I know last time me and you chatted, we had some really great reaction for it. And I think we hit a nerve with some of the people that we were sort of directly speaking to. But we have obviously a lot of listeners around the world who listen to this, who work in finance, they work in fintech, you know, across the world. And I assume many probably don't know what COBOL is. And that's not, you know, anybody listening to this going, how dare you, sir? But I don't mean it like an aspersion piece, but not many people do. In fact, actually, Ewan, that's sort of one of the problems, really, isn't it? I mean, maybe if we start at the beginning, why did COBOL gain so much popularity as a language of choice for programmers back in the day, and particularly for financial services? It seems to be well and truly deep seated.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about COBOL, you have to go back to the very, very, very beginning of computer programming.
The back to the like the space and time and like a Big Bang theory.
It's the Big Bang theory of computing, right? I mean, I think we forget that everyone talks about sort of banks as some kind of technical laggards. Banks aren't technical laggards. Banks have been at the forefront of computing, like literally from the very, very start. We kind of forget that computers only really exist in their modern form post the Second World War. You know, the UK invented them at GCHQ and the post office to crack a sort of a crack enigma, which the German spy things. And, you know, that was in the mid-1940s. And, you know, computers at the time, they were like literally wired together. You were wiring transistors and so on and so forth. You roll it forward a few years, and by a few years, I mean like 4, 5, 6, 7 years, something like that, in the mid-1950s. And you got companies like IBM had come along and created their sort of large mainframe tabulating machines. And they were tabulating machines because, you know, IBM was originally like a big calculator company, really. And, you know, these very early mainframes were still being wired together by people mixing, moving wires around and so on and so forth. And it became pretty clear very, very quickly that actually this just didn't work. You needed to actually start to have the idea of a language. So the original languages were things like assembly, which were like literally you're now telling the computer to move from this memory location to that memory location. Very, very fast, but not possible to do anything with it. So I guess late 1950s, early 1960s, a woman called Grace Hooper, who was probably one of the most preeminent computer programmers we ever had, you know, her impact is massive. She effectively came up with this language called COBOL, which was kind of one of the very first languages to be able to take computer instructions and turn them into basic English, and it was English at the time. And actually, COBOL is basically a dialect of a computer language that allows people to represent business decisions in a computer language. And it was transformative. And, you know, banks were the very forefront of this technology to move money around, you know, to sort of calculate money, to tabulate balances. Because if you think about what happens on an end-of-day process in a bank, it's like adding up all the ledger capabilities and so on and so forth. That's what a bank does. That's what a bank has always done. That's what a bank does nowadays. You know, nothing has fundamentally changed there. And COBOL was fundamental to that shift to actually embed computers in for the very first time.
It's funny, isn't it? For everything that we sort of talk about, I mean, we often talk about the, you know, that weird transition from analog through digitized to digital. You know, really the earliest form factor of from an analog physical, you know, money in the safe in the back and, you know, everything written down, like COBOL was the transitionary state into that digitized world, really, wasn't it? And actually to your point, the logic that could then be held within it that store of, you know, business logic and everything that went with that. This is really what it was there to do, wasn't it? It was that transitionary step.
Yeah, I mean, COBOL was transformative. You know, you went from old style paper ledgers, you know, which we've had since, you know, banking 1462 or whatever in Venice, Renaissance Venice, you know, and all they really did was take those ledgers and digitize them. So, you know, we also talk about that sort of the, you know, the banking battlefield and that shift from, you know, analog to digital to, you know, and they literally were taking analog capabilities and digitizing them. But, you know, I suppose the problem was that, you know, it was massively transformative, but the problem was they were so early on in the way that computer systems were built that actually they started to put all of their business logic very close to this COBOL, to the ledgers, because, you know, that kind of made sense for a bank to do that. And, you know, they didn't understand, it was 50, 60, 70 years ago, you know, even older than me or Sean, our chairman, or someone like that, you know. And we didn't understand how to build computer systems in those days. And you know, a large part of the bank's problems is that those early COBOL systems still exist. You know, they're still around. You know, maybe not the very, very earliest code, but it's been added onto and onto and onto. And so now you have this massive legacy of COBOL. You know, you talk about 200 odd billion lines of code. It's unsustainable.
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because for everything, and for anybody who knows, my background was computing as well. So anybody who knows sort of a little bit about COBOL, to your point, it's actually quite an elegant language, really, in terms of what it does. You know, there is a great level of reliability in terms of actually what you got there. It's, you know, it's not the hardest language to learn in terms of all of the infinite complexity that we've got in you know, modern day languages for this as well. You know, it's pretty scalable. The maintenance of it is, you know, relatively straightforward if you've got people who know what they're doing. So I guess, why are we sort of discussing it today as a problem? The thing that I always kind of liken it to, we've got a bad legacy in the UK of like building infrastructure and then being like, well, it's done and we're, you know, we walk away. Probably like the closest thing that I can relate it to is like the copper wires that transmit the internet around the UK as well. You know, at the beginning, it made a great deal of sense. Like copper was like, it was a, you know, very conductive setup. We could get, you know, great reliability through it. It was relatively cheap to do. But actually, in a digital age where fiber optic is able to carry much greater speeds and much greater reliability and the bandwidths be, you know, infinitely higher than copper could be, actually, your infrastructure is then the thing that's fundamentally holding you back. And very similar to the copper wires that we, you know, have running around the you know, out and beyond to, you know, carry bad broadband to everybody in the UK, then these things are generally, as COBOL is, very deep-seated in the organization. You know, the copper wires, we dug giant trenches and, you know, buried them under houses and all sorts of stuff. But actually, COBOL sits at the basis of most of the foundations of most of the banks, Ewan. So is that the issue? Is it that, you know, the infrastructure, and I mean infrastructure as the absolute base layer, is kind of not built in order to sustain the level of challenge of today?
Yeah, I mean, one of COBOL's problems is that it is super simple, and it is actually very elegant, as you say, for what it does. And you know, these mainframes that were put in the 60s, 70s, 80s, they actually work. They are very, very simple machines. These things work really, really well. And if you're running a large regulated organization like a bank, you don't really want to change that. And, you know, it doesn't make sense to change it in the 80s. It didn't make sense to change it in the 90s. It kind of didn't make sense to change it in the 20s and the 2010s, et cetera, et cetera. It never kind of makes sense. Because they are ultra-reliable at what they do, you know, counting up account balances, making sure transactions work, and so on and so forth. But the problem is that, you know, the world has moved on. You know, you kind of talk about sort of that copper cable going to fiber optic, et cetera. It's difficult for, you know, if a bank is got 5-10 million customers or something like that, it's very, very hard to transition off of a core system. You know, you only have to look around and see, you know, there's multiple examples of banks failing. Well, not necessarily failing, but, you know, that those core replacements are potentially career ending for a lot of people if they go wrong. It's just too risky for people. And so the COBOL just lingers because it's never quite bad enough to get rid of. You know, that's its problem. It's never quite bad enough to get rid of, and so you always keep it.
So we sort of move then to a kind of an era of sort of maintenance over replacement, don't we? It's more sort of cost effective and, to your point, less risky to sort of maintain those systems than it is to actually replace them. So, but I guess we've got to a point similar with, you know, my point around broadband, where actually it becomes the inhibitor. Is that the main risk, do you think, with COBOL today? Or, I mean, increasingly what we're sort of seeing as well is, you know, there's all sorts of different sort of organizations being spun up, you know, COBOL cowboys and all different things, where COBOL developers are getting paid a really lot of money just because actually the skill sets in order to maintain almost business critical infrastructure, you know, we're talking about, you know, one terminal to start up and reset your entire organization. I know we've talked to a couple of banks recently, Ewan, where, you know, we're hearing stories still about this, right? So is it the problem with the language, do you think, or is it necessarily the scarcity of the resource to actually deal with it?
I mean, I think it's probably, you go to university and say to somebody, you know, I tell you what I want you to do is I want you to learn a 60, 70-year-old language. People are going to be like, are you kidding me? There's no way these kids want to do it coming out of university. They always want to learn the latest JavaScript or, you know, whatever, you know, front-end language, React or you know, Swift or, you know, whatever the back-end language would be. They have no interest in learning something that's 60, 70 years old. So as a result, you know, the people who do that are in their 60s, 70s, 80s. So, you know, you talk about it. We talked to multiple banks where the bank has two or three engineers who are 70 or 80 years old and nobody there to take over.
There's a, I won't name the name of it, but there's a big UK bank who, you know, had a very large program that was going on where part of it would have let go of two people out of five people that were the only people who knew how to stand up and maintain a system that ran most of the bank. And actually, as you say, it's, you know, for all of the infrastructure, for all of the technology, for all of the things, you know, all of these things are written by people at the end of the day, right? And I do remember one very nice elderly chap being flown in by a helicopter to come finish, to come fix one of these systems, which is crazy, isn't it? But as you say, it's not unheard of given how underlying these things actually are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned COBOL, Cowboys. There are a lot of two or three organizations like that where, you know, people in the 70s or 80s are making very, very good money basically running the infrastructure. And you know,
it sounds like the plot line of a later stage version of like the movie Expendables. Do you know what I mean? It's like Bruce Willis kicks the door in and then fixes like five lines of COBOL and then disappears. Yeah. You know, like
that's exactly what it is, right? But it's you know, the problem, I suppose, for the banks is that what happened, you have a terminal problem here, and I mean that in the crudest possible sense. You know, if these guys, and they are all men, you know, if they were to pop their mortal coil, the bank has a single point of failure there. So trying to get people interested in understanding that actually there is an opportunity to learn COBOL, I think is really important. You know, there are people starting to try and educate, you know, bring on, add it to university systems. You know, companies are trying to, you know, open up training programs, but it's slow. And a lot of the problem isn't actually, you know, the language is very simple. You can learn the language quite quickly. The problem is to actually be able to go into the code base and understand what it actually does. Because, you know, as you and I know, pretty much no systems are documented inside banks. You know, the actual code that's running, it's, you know, here be dragons.
Yeah, it is an amazing one, isn't it? Again, you know, I love a good analogy, but I've seen a lot of organizations almost preparing. It's kind of like that that dye that they inject into people to see where it's going to. You know, I mean, the business logic and the impact of these systems is very much unknown. And the challenge on that, to your point earlier on, Ewan, is that there's sort of almost the sedimentary rock lines, you know, the things that have been built on top of these systems, heavily reliant on those things that people just don't really understand. So, you know, the implications of this on a business could be the business grinds to an absolute halt because actually not only is there a problem, but nobody really understands how to fix it. And to your point, that the people who could have fixed it have been let go a long time ago. So, I mean, it is an interesting challenge, isn't it? You know, I guess that it comes back to how do you, we started at the beginning of this conversation saying, you know, most of our listeners probably don't work with COBOL every day. They're like, you know, we're building mobile apps and we're building these capabilities and, you know, we're doing all of these other stuff. So, you know, why should somebody actually care about this? Is it because it's like telling somebody that your lovely house that you really, really like is built on sand, right?
Yeah, it's great for the mobile developers or the front-end guys who want sort of, dynamic sort of notifications and so on and so forth. But the problem is, and the reason the banks can't do it, is because these notifications need to come from the very, very core of the banking system. That's what a core banking system actually is at the end of the day. And these systems are COBOL, and it's not designed to sort of face into an internet world. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the code is bad. The code is excellent at what it does. It's just not designed for real-time notifications. It's a batch orientated system because banks were batch orientated until very, very recently. In fact, most banks still are batch orientated, right? The idea of building a real time event driven bank is almost unheard of. But, and so things like COBOL work really, really well. But then when you want to make that shift from a batch orientated world to an event driven world, you need a fundamentally different computer architecture underneath it. And that isn't just COBOL, that's your entire worldview needs to change.
Yeah, the orchestration of everything through that stack at that stage becomes very different, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, what it is that you need, but fundamentally the services that you're trying to deliver up to your interfaces and up to your customers ultimately, right? That's the opportunity with, you know, we talk about digital riches, which is a real-time, intelligent, contextual, human, extendable, and social, but in a riches world, then actually your ability to deliver things immediate or in the context of where people are or, you know, what situation that they're in, you know, the speed that they're moving, like whatever, like anything that you kind of want to sort of play with. It's very difficult to do that in a batch sense. It's very easy to do that if you've got more of an event-driven architecture, an event-driven data setup, isn't it? So I guess the challenge really, I mean, why should anybody care about this? It's not because some COBOL engineer is getting £400,000 for, you know, the modern day, you know, magic screwdriver sort of setup with some servers. It is that fundamentally, without solving these deep-seated problems, you're probably never really ever going to be able to deliver the things that you really want to. And I would say the other thing that this is, it's almost the disease to most of the symptoms. You know, when you look at symptoms of actually, you know, probably no challenger banks have this problem because they've been born in a digital age. They've been built on, you know, different types of foundations, modern architecture, you know, cloud-based capabilities, yada, 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 right? It's almost the old adage of like beauty is only skin deep. That's not true. Like beauty, when it comes to the capabilities you can deliver to customers, goes like all the way down to the core of your bone, you know, in that sense. And at many organizations, COBOL being at that core is what's causing not only the risk all the way through that system, but fundamentally the inability to truly meet the potential that you can in a digital age, right?
Yeah, I mean, COBOL is actually, if we're being brutally honest, it's probably a synonym or a proxy for the underlying core problems. And that's just the way the architecture is set up. You know, this monolithic mainframe, it's not necessarily the mainframe that's the problem, it's the monolithic view of the world. The fact that, you know, because of history and 60, 70 years ago, we didn't understand how to build systems. They've layered stuff on top of it. You know, but then actually that manifests itself not just through technology. You know, your governance processes and your operational processes then become sort of batch orientated and monolithic in their own view of the world. And I think, you know, that's one of the defining characteristics of, you know, we've talked about it multiple times, you know, the challenger banks. Their technology is different, but actually then the way they run their bank is different. And that, you know, and the two things are symbiotic. You know, we talk about Conway's law, you know, the idea that your computer architecture impacts your operational and business architecture and vice versa. COBOL, because it was so successful and because computers in the 60s and 70s and 80s were so expensive, they became monolithic. Banks have now become monolithic because of that. Banks built in the new generation are natively cloud-based. They're natively the opposite of monolithic, and therefore everything, all their thought processes change differently. And that's the fundamental problem. COBOL is just a symptom of that wider problem.
100%. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll discuss if COBOL isn't the best answer, then where should banks be looking for better alternatives? Back with you very soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The time for community banks and credit unions to win is now. While the big players and exciting new challenges grab headlines, regional institutions are at the heart of the banking ecosystem, putting the service back into financial services. Serving their local communities, these organisations around the world have a unique advantage over their competitors. They have deep, established roots with their customers. They offer a local, personal service, and they're not tangled up in the legacy tech mess that the big banks are. To read, watch, and listen to what else we've got to say about them and how they can win, visit 11fs.com/communitybanks. That's 11fs.com/communitybanks.
Well, Welcome back to FinTech Insider Insights. Hopefully by now you've got a much better idea of what COBOL actually is and how banks are actually using it. But is it the right way? And if it isn't, with all of the arguments that you heard before the break, then actually how, as an industry, do we find a better solution? And actually just knowing the answer is one thing, but how do you actually get there? That's always the biggest challenge, isn't it? So I guess, Ewan, look, if COBOL isn't working and there are, you know, real examples of change here, why don't banks just change it? You know, you touched on this a little bit, point with the core banking, you know, transformations and those things. I mean, is it just nobody elects for heart surgery? Is that the problem?
Yeah, it is transformative. It's you're going to have to fund them because, as I sort of talked about just before the break, you know, COBOL, your computer architectures, they fundamentally drive your business architectures as well, you know, Conway's Law. Actually having to go in and change these computer systems often require banks to fundamentally reimagine a new way of working. And actually, that's the hard part. It's not the technology. The technology is relatively easy. It's the people and the governance and the operational processes and making those changes. You know, if you're running 10 million, 20 million accounts on a major bank in the UK, actually getting, you know, 10,000 people to change the way they work, that's the hard part.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, when people sort of refer to the, you know, the spaghetti underpinning many infrastructures, much of that spaghetti is how people work, isn't it? And that's it is a really interesting sort of problem to get there. But I guess in terms of migrating away from those systems, I mean, to your point, the big bang, let's do a 5-year transformation, you know, let's make sure we implement the latest version of, you know, name your core banking vendor here. There's not many occasions where I can say that that's gone tremendously well for people. You know, typically, I know me and you talked to clients about this before, but, you know, generally everybody migrates their data. Generally, everybody replicates all of their existing product sets. And what you end up with is just paralyzing your organization for 4 years, right? So is that the biggest sort of driver for, you know, while everybody's pursuing shareholder value and increasing, you know, your penetration of products and customer base and all these things, then almost dealing with that flat tire you've got becomes a, well, let's just keep pumping it up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we know that, you know, banks are, if you look at some of the big US banks, they're spending, you know, $10 to $15 billion a year just on their IT budgets. And the vast majority of that is maintenance. And, you know, if you're just going to keep on maintaining it, you actually end up putting layers and layers on top of your maintenance code as well. So it becomes slower and slower and slower. And I think if you look at the success stories of people, you're right. There is very few people who've actually done a full core migration and got away with it. You know, a lot more people have failed and failed quite miserably. I think where it does work is you always have to set up a little satellite off to the side. You know, actually you need a greenfield operation in some way, shape or form to be able to build out and prove new ways of working, new ways of governance, new ways of running your technology capability, and then work out a mechanism by which you can jump from the big system to the new system. Very few people, I think there were good examples of people who have built those systems off the side. I mean, you know, you think about one of the first systems we built here, Metal, you know, for RBS. You know, doing very, very well nowadays. But actually making that system for, you know, how would NatWest jump from the core NatWest systems onto the new Metal system to be built? That's the next problem they really have to face into. That's the challenge.
And do you think, I mean, obviously, you know, the sort of really heyday of, you know, sort of expansion in international banking and, you know, NatWest buying, RBS buying this and that, and, you know, HSBC buying that, you know, actually that sort of antagonistic problem really, isn't it? Because to your point around all of those monolithic structures, when you're, I think for a decade, nobody really integrated anything. You know, I mean, people were too busy, you know, acquiring customers and taking over new markets. So, you know, acquiring all of those monolithic structures and then, you know, never really seeing the ROI off the back of it. I almost kind of think, you know, for some big global banks now, to your point on the challenge, I don't think this is a technology challenge. It's getting 15 CIOs to agree with what the answer actually is and where you're actually going to go with it, right? So, I mean, this is not just a a big bank problem, but do the small banks, the, you know, the maybe the monoline banks or the single geography, or, you know, if you're looking at the US or Canada, the sort of community banks that have a similar problem, but maybe a more simplistic decision-making criteria when it comes to, you know, access to the C-suite and the board, do they have potentially an advantage in terms of their decision-making here to solve this problem, do you think?
I think potentially they do. I suppose if you looked at the smaller banks, the mutuals and the credit unions and you know the tiers twos and threes of the world, historically you would have said, oh, they're kind of the poor brethren of the financial community. They don't really have the money, you know, they don't really have the reach, and you know, they kind of looked up to the big banks and said, oh, I wish I could be a big bank. But actually, the reality is not having that money and not having that reach meant they haven't built a lot of the systems in the way the big banks have done and almost had to do the way the big banks had to do those systems. So actually the smaller banks now, they're in a place where they can unwind a lot of their capabilities. It's not such a, it's not open heart surgery. You know, maybe they've got a broken bone or two and you've got to reset it, but it can be done. But actually, you know, you are speaking to the doctor in a small bank. You know, the CEO, you can have a face-to-face conversation with them and they actually understand the world they're living in. Not say the big bank CEOs don't understand the world they're living in. Of course they understand the world they're living in. But actually the small bank CEO has the potential to change the world. What they need is that, I think, you know, if you look at the way that, you know, the technology suppliers of this, that they're not aimed at helping these small banks at the moment. You know, everyone is still trying to sell big systems into the large banks because that's where you make your money. Actually, what's needed, I think, for the smaller banks is someone to come along and start to help these guys put together a next-generation view of the world. Because, you know, they are almost like the satellite banks that the big banks are trying to set up on the side. The small banks are already there. That's actually what they're doing. But they just need to start making internal changes and building out their capability that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a problem, isn't it? Because almost we talk about the banking battlefield quite a lot, but the battlefield isn't just the things that you see. It's not just the scaling of the customers in terms of actually the impact that people have on the market, you know, the apps, the features, the functionality. It's actually all the things that sit underneath that, aren't they? And actually, I mean, I often say, you know, top of any global CEO's list is, dear God, my OPEX cost is getting out of hands. And like anything that I do, you know, CapEx-y just seems to just layer more OPEX cost on. What, like, how do I solve for that problem, right? But is this a process or a problem that can be solved, or is it increasingly a sort of a Gordian knot? You know, it's the millstone around their neck to kind of carry forwards. Because, you know, actually, and really, is this the strategic advantage of the fintech challenger banks that are being built today? Because they don't have any of these legacy issues, do they? They don't have any of those incumbent problems because their technology capabilities is relatively new. I guess I always go back to, and I love stealing your story on this one, Ewan, but you always say that, you know, brilliant systems are grown, they're not delivered. And actually, is this actually more of an indication of the way that banks look at technology wrongly, which is it's a project that you deliver and then it's done, rather than actually something you've continually got to be evolving, you've got to continually ensuring it's relevant to the market you operate in and the problems that you're fundamentally trying to solve? I think it does. I think that's the issue. It's your technology isn't encased in concrete forever and a day. It's something that you've got to continually be tending to, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a large bank, almost nobody is taking a proper holistic systemic view of both the way the bank operates, you know, operationally and probably from a governance perspective, but certainly from a technology perspective. You know, this idea, you know, banks are addicted to projects. That's how they view the world. I'll set something up, I'll get it launched. And then, you know, the definition of success in a project isn't actually, does it help the long-term systemic direction of the bank? It's, have I actually met my budget for this particular project? So what happens is that, you know, the easiest way to do a project is to control everything in your domain. So you go and get your own new core system, you get your own KYC system, you go your own fraud system, etc. And what that means is that a large bank will end up with 10, 15, 20, 50 different KYC systems, fraud systems, and so on and so forth. They all make sense on a per project basis, but systemically, they make no sense at all. And I think what needs, and this is, you know, it's where the opportunity is for the smaller banks, because actually they can take a systemic view of the world. If I was the COO of a major, you know, global bank, actually I would be putting a lot of my maintenance money to actually building out almost a wholesale capability of the bank. Because, you know, banking is simple: storing money, moving money, lending money. You know, that's really what a bank is about. Sure, you know, all the differences at the top, the jobs to be done, the regulation, etc. But actually, you know, people get fixated on that, and the actual core of a bank is really quite simple. But you look at these large banks, almost nobody has these conceptual abstractions in their banking systems to deal with these ideas, and they end up building each one bang 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 on a per project basis. So you know, your CapEx and your OpEx just get way out of line. A smaller bank, actually, you could potentially make that jump. You know, it is not so hard for you to do that, because your bank is effectively just one project. You know, how do you as a CEO of a smaller bank use that agility, and it is agility, to your advantage?
Very good. I mean, it's been an interesting conversation. Like you say, you know, you sort of talk about COBOL in this sort of like it's almost a forgotten language, like Latin, you know. But in many instances, you know, the places where we find Latin most used is, you know, in the banking industry for various different setups. And it's very similar to what we're seeing with COBOL. I think hopefully what you've heard is this isn't just a back office or deep-seated technology problem, but actually this is something that affects all the way through the stack. You know, what you do at the bottom of the technology capability really does affect what happens from a customer experience perspective. And I think like any problem that we all know we've got that we put off for too long, these things have a tendency to come back and bite you on the butt, don't they, rather than going away in that way. So on that note, we probably better leave it here, Ewan, because I think we could probably rant about this one for a long time, but we'll leave it today. And thank you so much for joining me. Where can people learn a little bit more about you or reach out to you or have any of the views that you've had today?
Probably the best place is on LinkedIn. So if you look me up, Ewan Silver on LinkedIn, you'll find me there.
Very cool. As for me, if you want to chat to me about all things COBOL, feel free to drop me an email, david@11fs.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you've heard, follow our podcast. Don't forget to leave us a review. Helps everybody find the show and helps us make it better as well. And remember, if you like this episode, do check out Decoding Banks, where we break down COBOL as well as loads of other stuff that you can help you understand financial services and banking a little bit better. As always, if you want to join the conversation, you can find us on social media. Just search for 11FS or Tech Insider, or email us on podcasts@11fs.com. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Goodbye.
The time for community banks and credit unions to win is now. While the big players and exciting new challenges grab headlines, regional institutions are at the heart of the banking ecosystem, putting the service back into financial services. Serving their local communities, these organisations around the world have a unique advantage over their competitors. They have deep, established roots with their customers. They offer a local, personal service, and they're not tangled up in the legacy tech mess that the big banks are. To read, watch, and listen to what else we've got to say about them and how they can win, visit 11fs.com/communitybanks. That's 11fs.com/communitybanks.